Bank is being used in reverse. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Interesting way to look at it with the arc welder and a magnifying glass. That's another good representation. But when I read that question, I just thought that would be interesting to cover because we didn't cover the reverse of that on transmission. So I'm sure he's got a better understanding or confirmed what he thought. All right, Dick, that's it from the mailbag. Let's go over to Paul and see what he's got for us. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
WS2N is about to give us the space report number 190 of the series. I think Mr. Elon Musk was supposed to do a launch in the last couple of days, and I think it got canceled. But when that launch does take place, and I think you're going to give us a website by which we can get a live feed, which is not a NASA feed because he's not a NASA person, even though he is supporting NASA. I believe he's going to make another attempt for the booster to come back and land safely. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
This is WS2N for the space report. TechNet. Number 190. Yeah, I sent you an email back after you sent me the one on the Deep Space Network, which is very good, by the way. A lot of fun to navigate through that. Mentioned in the beginning of the net, but the website you go to either one I sent you is the SpaceX webcast. You can put that to Google and bring that up. Or you go to the SpaceX.com and you'll see a link there to click on live transmission for any of the launches. And most of their launches are actually commercial, not with NASA. They'll launch cargo up to the International Space Station, or they'll launch spacecraft put out at the L1 position one time. That's all NASA. But a lot of them are commercial.
Paul, let me interrupt you. Is your antenna aimed in the normal direction? You sound good, but there's a little bit of hiss in the background. I wonder if you could aim it a little bit better to give us a little bit less hiss. And one way to test that would be, say, I'm rotating clockwise and you count. This is number 1, 2, 3, 4, and we'll tell you which one is the loudest. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
This should be better. My grandson changed it on me earlier today. How's this, Dick?
Fantastic improvement. Okay. Good. Keep going, Paul. K2RIW.
And I got to get up there and loosen up the coax. The RG8U was a little too taut. Kind of like worked its way through the tape, so I have to get up there and fix that so I can rotate this thing better without putting too much of a strain on it. The launch was supposed to go up tonight, quarter to seven. Now this is actually the third scrub. They tried earlier last week, and they had problems with the liquid oxygen. They bring it down normally to a cryogenic level. Now they're going even 50 degrees below that, roughly. We tried to make it more densify the oxygen, and the same for the propellant, the kerosene. Instead of that being room temperature or ambient temperature, they bring that down to roughly 20 degrees, and that densifies that as well. They can get more fuel onto the rocket for either heavier or more distant launches. For instance, they had a launch recently back in December. They successfully landed the booster back at Cape Canaveral. They were 11 satellites, but roughly around 400 miles up. This satellite is a heavy communication satellite, SES-9, that's going to geo-transfer orbit 23,000 miles up, and very heavy. It's around 12,000 pounds. so that they need as much fuel as possible. What's going to happen is with the extra densification, they should have some extra fuel, enough fuel, hopefully, to make it to the barge down below. They don't have enough fuel for a boost back all the way back to Cape Canaveral, so they can't do that again on this flight. They'll be going roughly twice the speed, the booster will, compared to last December's flight. So, not enough fuel to get back to Cape Canaveral, but enough to slow themselves down to 0 forward degrees, and then drop straight down, and then ignite the three engines again. There's 9 engines, but for boost back purposes, they do 3. And then they should have enough fuel for a final burn to try to land on a barge. Barge is much further out than last time, usually about 150 to 200 miles. This thing is about 400 miles out. They did say that they might have live coverage, where hopefully in a couple of days when they launch again, it was scrubbed again tonight. Actually, they halted the countdown a minute or so before launch. They had a range problem, ship down range. They have to keep the area clear of boats. You know, it's a narrow area, but if there's a boat there, they have to, the range officer will call a halt. So it was a hold, came across and lay the launch. Now with these cryogenic fuels, they have to load them on, and within a half hour, get the rocket off the pad. If not, they have to have to board, put the fuel back into the tanks on the ground, and then do it all over again. So that's the penalty that they pay. They can't just leave the fuel in the tank for a long period of time on the rocket. But they did manage to try it again. They got down to 0. The water suppression, the sound suppression system came on. The 9 engines lit up. And I thought they were going to take off, but they immediately shut down. Onboard computers shut the whole system down. The release mechanisms stayed locked onto the Falcon 9, and that's it. And they thought maybe they tried again. They had a long enough window, but they finally decided to abort to another day. Waiting on that date. I'll check the website, probably tomorrow.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I'll try again tomorrow morning to find out when the next attempt will be. And the reason that's important for me, anyway, is they've tried this to try to land on barges 3 different times, and each time they get closer and closer. Last time, they launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base, California, and put a NASA, European Space Agency, Jason 3 satellite up, and that's a successful launch, but they tried to recover the booster. It did land on the barge, but one of the legs did not lock into place, fell over. So hopefully it'll make it one of these times. When they do that, will be history. You know, they've done it back to land. They just haven't been able to do it on a barge yet. Let me drop it. The reason it's so important to do it on a barge is for these particular launches, geostationary transfer orbits that they want to do, and as well as some of the heavier launches that they have planned in the near future. They have a test flight coming up in probably around September, the Falcon Heavy, which is essentially 3 Falcon 9s bolted together, using 2 of the Falcon 9s as eventually on a regular basis using these things, and they want to reuse the, you know, all three cores, bring two of them back to launch complex one, which is now called Landing Zone 13. SpaceX brought it up and land two of the cores there, and then the center one, which will be again too far out over the ocean to come back to Cape Canaveral, that one will land on a barge, and this way they can reuse all these 27 Merlin 1D rockets. So that's the story on SpaceX. Let me drop it. WS2N. Another story that's coming up will be Tuesday night. So you have Scott Kelly and Mikhail Kornienko, the Russian, coming back after almost a year in space. And that will make the news. You'll see it out on all the news stations when these guys are landing in Russia. So they'll come down and parachute on the Soyuz spacecraft, and they want to see how they react after flying around in a year in space. Russians have done this type of thing before. They've gone over a year with a couple of their astronauts. It's the first time for the United States to do that. And as time goes on, they have eventually planned other one-year missions for our guys. But there's three of them coming back, two of them that have been up there for a year, and then Sergei Volkov is going to be the commander of the Soyuz 18M when they return, I think it's like 11:30 or something at night. So we'll see it probably on the news on the 2nd. Let me drop it. Again in the commercial world of rocketry, we have Orbital ATK, which launches the Cygnus spacecraft. That's a craft built by them to resupply the International Space Station, and they've done this a couple of times, but back in October of 2014, they're the ones that had their rocket blow up above the launch pad in Wallops Island, Virginia. That's where their home is located. That's where they launched from. Since then, they've rented a flight aboard an Atlas V from Lockheed and Boeing, United Launch Alliance, they call it. And they successfully did that last December. Cygnus brought up roughly 10,000 pounds worth of stuff and stayed aboard, attached to the space station for a couple of months, and just left recently for an up over the Pacific Ocean. So they're going to have another launch like that, needed to complete their contract with NASA for all their cargo missions, and they weren't able to use their spaceport. So that one was launched out of Florida, and they're going to do another one this March, I think March 22nd, they're going to do it again. And then after that, they will be reusing or redoing their launches from Wallops Island again, which is pretty interesting. You know, the time of day it goes off, you can actually see it from Long Island low on the horizon. But they'll be using different rocket engines. They got rid of the NK-33s, the Russian engines that they were using. Now they have different Russian engines, the RD-181s, similar bulb patterns, so they didn't have to do too many changes to the Antares rocket. Orbital ATK builds its Antares rocket. They'll be launching again in March, back in business. Three companies have signed up now for continuing supplying the International Space Station over the next up until 2024. SpaceX got a new contract for a multiple flight six, as well as Orbital ATK. They got six, at least six, they guarantee for Fargo than Orville ATK. That'll be probably about 3 years or so from now. You'll start to see that go up. And that's the one that looks like a very small space shuttle will land on a regular runway. So that's pretty much it, Dick. There's other things, but go over. I have plenty of space topics. We won't run out anytime soon, especially when manned flight starts getting, you know, American manned flight starts going. We'll be doing manned flight and cargo flights and knows what else. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N for the space report for the TechNet.
I wonder if we should tell people about this beautiful website that Mike number 2, K1MJM, brought to our attention. This NASA website where you can go to each one of the Deep Space Network antennas and find out at this instant of time what is it listening to, where is it aimed, if it's transmitting signals to that spacecraft, how many watts is it transmitting, how many bits per second is it transmitting. When it's receiving a signal, they'll tell you how many bits per second a signal is receiving, and they'll tell you how strong the signal it's receiving. Beautiful website. Let me drop. While it was listening to, the first time I went to the website last night, it was listening to Voyager, my favorite aircraft, my favorite spacecraft. And it was telling you exactly what direction in azimuth and elevation the dish was aimed, and you could watch the direction slowly change as the Earth was rotating. They tell you exactly how strong is the signal being received. Once I knew how strong the signal was being received, and I know how many bits per second, if, for instance, you're transmitting 50 kilobits per second of data, you can make a rough guess that the bandwidth of that signal being listened to is 50 kilohertz. It takes roughly 50 kilohertz of receiver bandwidth with an optimal receiver to listening to a signal transmitting 50 kilobits per second. But if the signal is being transmitted by amplitude modulation, phase modulation, doesn't make a great deal of difference. Within a small amount of inaccuracy, it calculates the bandwidth. Once I knew the bandwidth of the signal, and I knew the signal strength, I could then calculate what noise figure of low noise amplifier is required in order to be able to receive that signal at roughly a 10 decibel carrier to noise ratio. The next question is, why did I choose 10? Let me drop. A rough rule of thumb, when you're listening to a signal, you got 10 decibels of carrier to noise ratio of an ideal receiver. You have a reasonably low bit error rate. Yep, 1 bit of error every million bits or something like that. 10 to the minus 6 bit error rate. And so the forward error correcting code that they use for data transmission can tolerate a significant number of errors, very similar to what's going on with your hard drive. Most of the time you seem to get very few errors out of your hard drive when you play material back after recording it into your hard drive. What's really going on is those packets have, each packet has on average probably an error or two. But because there's a built-in error correcting code in the way the data is put into the packets, by way of a parity check or a redundancy cyclic code, you can find out whether or not there's any error in the data, and you start applying the error correcting code, and you can correct the error. Your DNA is doing that, your hard drive is doing that, NASA is doing that with the data that we see. But in the ideal world, you'd like to have 10 dB of carrier to noise ratio to start off with a low enough, reasonable data error rate so you don't have to do an awful lot of this extra processing. Let me drop. So from that information from that website last night, I was able to calculate that their low noise amplifier has to have 15 degrees of Kelvin of noise equivalent temperature in order to have a low enough noise figure, which calculates to be something like a tenth of a dB of noise figure. So their cryogenically cooled low noise amplifier has to act electronically like 50 degrees Kelvin in order for all that to work. I suddenly realize now that by way of the data they've given us, I can go the next step. All the data is there. I know they're listening to Voyager on a 240-foot diameter dish. I know the downlink signal is roughly 8 gigahertz in frequency. A 240-foot dish at 65% surface accuracy, surface efficiency, what do they call it now? Main lobe efficiency? No. Aperture efficiency. I therefore can calculate that the 240-foot dish has a gain of 73.5 dB, and it's got 2 seconds of arc of beam width. Think about that. This dish, 240-foot in diameter, is more than an acre in area. An acre of area of dish that's fully steerable in azimuth and elevation. And the website also tells you how fast is the local wind speed. Because beyond a certain wind speed, they can't maintain the aiming of that dish to the nearest 2 minutes of arc. A 30th of a degree is the beam width of that dish when it's receiving or transmitting at 8 gigahertz. Let me drop. And the dish on Voyager itself, which I think is around 8 feet in diameter, that gives it very close to a 1 degree total beam width, which means you want to steer the spacecraft aiming that dish at Earth to nearest plus or minus a fifth of a degree or so, to make sure that the main lobe is aimed directly at Earth so that it's getting the data correctly. So you know the dish gain at Voyager, you know the dish gain at NASA on the ground, you know the signal strength at NASA receiving, therefore I can calculate and I know the exact number of miles, because they tell you the number of miles, or they tell you the total round trip time, which was something like 1.55 days. It turns out to be something like 38 hours of round trip time. So know that the free space, the vacuum between Voyager and us, has no insertion loss. So every bit of the signal they transmit gets to the Earth, just as long as there is the huge thunderstorm going on above the dish that's receiving. You know exactly what signal strength is coming through that atmosphere. At 8 gigs, the atmosphere is extremely transparent most of the time. So, by all of the raw data they've given us, let me drop. I suddenly realized that with a few percent of inaccuracy, a few percent of error, I can calculate exactly how many watts of power is Voyager transmitting now. And I think the answer is going to come out close to 6 watts. I've been saying that for some time. Now, they've given us the raw data to find out exactly what it really is. So here we are, 37 years downrange on this spacecraft, going out there at 40-some-odd thousand miles an hour, moving away from us, something like 8 or so billion miles, almost 3 times the distance to Pluto is where it is, and that QRP 6-watt signal is talking to us and intends to do that up until the year like 2022, I think you told us, Paul. So, interesting calculations. The raw data is there. And so, if you're curious, you can calculate exactly how many watts is being transmitted right now. So, I've forgotten how long that website is. I wonder if we should try to tell people how to go to that website, Paul. WS2N, K2IW, the TechNet.
Oh, okay, Dick, I'll give it to you. It's, by the way, 12 feet on the diameter of the Voyager dishes. We went over that one other time. I think it was 12 feet. And it sounds big, but that's what it is. A lot of leftover money. There was a lot of momentum after the Apollo landings. We were able to send 2 very large spacecraft to Mars called Viking. That was part of the money momentum, as well as the 2 Voyager spacecraft that did the grand tour of the outer planets. But yeah, it's the deep space network is https://eyes.nasa.gov/DSN. That stands for Deep Space Network. /, again, it's dsn.html. So it's really eyes.nasa.gov /DSN/DSN.html. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's a real good website. Lots and lots of information. So you can look at every one of their antennas, find out what they're listening to right now. Is there an uplink? Is there a downlink? How strong is the signal? What's the nature of the data? How fast? And so on. How is it being aimed in azimuth and elevation in order to track that spacecraft? And that transmitting dish has a 240-foot diameter dish at 8 gigs. Has 2 minutes of arc, a 30th of a degree of beam width. Is that a pencil beam? Wow. 73.5 dB of gain. That's a lot of gain. Let me think now. Was the number 73? I think it was. If it was 73, let's see, 60 is 1,000,000 to 1, 70 is 10,000,000 to 1, 73 is 20,000,000 to 1. So whatever number of watts you put into that dish, the signal coming out of the dish because of its gain, looks like it is 20 million times stronger. 1 watt in looks like 20 million watts coming out, as if it was an isotropic antenna with 20 million watts. That's focusing. Oh boy. And beautiful piece of hardware. I was at the 240-foot dish at Goldstone, California, which is in the middle of Fort Irwin, an Army base. I think I told you I was doing some work out at the Edwards Air Force Base, which is about 30 or so miles away. Can't remember the exact distance. Can we drop it? So I had this badge that was issued by Edwards Air Force Base. I got up to the guard booth at Fort Irwin, the guard booth that goes toward NASA. I flashed that badge. They didn't ask any questions. It had the right color. And so at 2 o'clock in the morning, I ended up at the Goldstone dish, the 240-foot dish. I walked into the front door, met a couple of engineers on the night shift, and started talking to them. They didn't ask any questions as to why I was there. One of them was asking me, are you familiar with the conversion for degrees Kelvin into noise figure in decibels? And I said, yes, sir. That's one of the equations that I've memorized. I wrote it out for him on a piece of paper. He thanked me. He was trying to figure out something about how well their low noise amplifier was working that night. And he either wanted the answer in decibels of noise figure or degrees Kelvin. He wanted the conversion from one to the other. And I supplied that to him. A guy out of the blue. And as I said, they never asked me how I got there and who gave me authorization to be there. They never asked that question. I tried taking a picture of that dish. It's got a bunch of floodlights aimed at it. And I had a pretty yucky camera with me, and I tried taking a picture of it that night. Unfortunately, that picture didn't come out. But boy, that thing is big. More than an acre of antenna. And that's actually small compared to... Let me drop... The dish at Green Bank, West Virginia, the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, that dish is... all of a sudden, I've forgotten the diameter. I think it's... 100 meters, yes. I think it's 100 meters, 300 feet in diameter, if I got the number right. Really, really big. And what's unique about that dish in the Green Bank, the radio telescope, is that it's made of something like 2,600 individual panels for the parabolic reflector. And each one of those panels has motors in the corner where they can be tuned in order to make the accuracy whatever you want for the frequency you're operating at, as a function of temperature, wind load, snow, and everything else. That dish keeps its accuracy. So that dish, under normal circumstances, would be useful up to about 3 gigahertz, but because it's got that correcting procedure built in, it can be used up to 110 gigahertz. And you calculate the beam width of that thing, which I can do. I think we're getting down to a small fraction of a minute of arc. We're getting into seconds of arc of beam width. And so they got some really hefty motors to aim that thing in azimuth and elevation. So, anybody have any further questions for Paul on the subject of spacecraft, give us your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, a comment about one of last week's topics, WS2N.
Go right ahead, Paul.
they talked about Apollo 10 heard music on the dark side of the moon. And I looked into it. What happened was that, I think it was the next day or the day after, CBS 880, you know, kilohertz, regular AM radio, they had mentioned it as well. So sure enough, this comes from a show on the Science Channel. I'm trying to think of the name of it. But it's NASA's Unexplained Files, I think. This is, you know, it's one of these things that's on a couple of times a week. And that was one of the episodes that they had. And they you know, they kind of hype things up on that show. They kind of take everything they say with a grain of salt. For instance, talk about a space shuttle going up, one of the earliest space shuttles, you know, Sally Ryder or something. You know, all this should be a space shuttle doing a backflip in space. And what they don't tell you is, you know, the only way they could film that was with the later ones that went to the space station. So, you know, they'll interview astronauts. I don't know if they're taking things out of context. They make it seem like a lot of the astronauts, you know, well, they believe in all the UFOs that they're seeing. I think they stretch the truth. But it turns out, anyway, the radio situation here, I heard it, and it's just a roaring noise, and it's, you know, like a squeal. It doesn't sound anything like music. They said it sounded like music. It doesn't. And then it was one report, I think it was an independent report that came out that a couple of the radios on board, you know, you had the LEM and you had the command module. Maybe they were talking to each other. You know, the frequencies were making the other one, you know, make a sound. I was thinking maybe in the mod or something between the two. But they made a thing out of it. Some of these shows you got to watch. Watch the way they tell you these stories. They like to hype it up. They got music in the background and this and that. I think they really put things out of context. Back to you, Dick.
I'm reasonably sure that a number of the astronauts on the Apollo program did see things in space that are hard to explain, quite possibly UFOs. And so, what's your opinion on that, Paul? I know that NASA, of course, doesn't make a big thing about it, but I think the individual astronauts, once they retire from the service, will tell you, yes, on my mission, I saw such and such, and each one of us on board saw it, and it's rather hard to explain what it was. I think it was on Apollo 11, the one where Armstrong and Aldrin walked on the moon the first time. I think there was a episode that you can play back where Armstrong or Aldrin are asking NASA, where is the booster that we abandoned, that we jettisoned? Where should it be now? Because we think we're seeing it. Well, that was coded language. They knew damn well that they're moving away from that booster that they had jettisoned at a zillion miles an hour. And here we are a couple of hours downrange. The chances of them seeing that are zero. But they asked NASA, should we be seeing that booster at this time? Do you remember that incident, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, that was the S4B third stage booster. After they launch and they go to translunar orbit, TLO, TLI, translunar injection. After they're on the way to the moon, though. So they're still attached to the S4B. So they disconnect from that. They do a 180, and they go back toward it inside the bearing, LEM, and they dock with that, and they pull that out, and now the S4B follows them. You know, they have little thrusters on board, and they'll thrust her, you know, thrust her away. And then a day or two later, there. In that case, I remember that story. The booster was 6,000 miles away, so the theory was there's no way they were going to see that. But they saw something. But you know, UFOs, hardly. I don't think so. But they might be seeing reflections. Who knows? I think that's the case. I think that was the one with the. They saw spots in their eyes. They saw things going, you know, flying past. Let me drop it. Was Chesnoff effect or something with the cosmic rays hitting the outside of the craft and then creating secondary rays going through their eyes, actually passing right through their body, but the ones that went through their eyes, they were picking them up as little lights. Well, for a long time, they didn't know what that was. Could have been little tiny spaceships zooming through the spacecraft. You know, if some of these people get a hold of the story, you know, in the end, most of the stuff is explainable. But yeah, many stories aren't. They saw things and weren't sure what it was. But to actually practically tell everybody it's a UFO and dramatic music behind it is. You're responsible. Back to you, sir.
Yeah, we take for granted all the protection we get from our atmosphere. The Earth is continuously being bombarded by a large number of cosmic rays, particles moving at very close to the speed of light. And when you, as an astronaut, are in a spacecraft, you're above that atmosphere and you're not getting that protection. Each of these cosmic rays that hit your spacecraft, these are atomic level objects, very small, but they go roaring right through the spacecraft, right through your eye, and so they are moving faster than the speed of light of your eye, inside of your vitreous humor or aqueous humor, and therefore any object entering a medium where it's moving faster than the speed of light gives off something called Cherenkov radiation. You get a blue streak of light from each one of those particles hitting your eye. So at nighttime, when your eyes are dark adapted and they're closed, you're in a dark room, you will continuously see every so often these streaks of light in your eye. But it's not a very bright streak of light. I think the eye has to be dark adapted and your eye has to be closed. I think you almost do not see that in the daytime when you're looking at normal objects. So I think that's what you were mentioning, Paul. Does that sound right? WS2N, K2LAW.
Yes, that's exactly right. So, yeah, I wanted to bring that up. I mean, they're good shows to watch because you do learn a lot. You know, you start to learn the names of some of the spacecraft and how many pounds of thrust they had. They tell you good things. Rendezvous with each other and how they dock, undock. You get a vague idea of what's going on. So I think it's very good for that. It's all history, so very important. Back to you, Dick.
You said that, Paul, it is a good show to watch. Right now, I'm not sure. You didn't tell us what show you're talking about, so there's a number of programs that'll tell you what took place on Apollo 11, 13, and so on. So the show you're talking about right now, Paul, what's the show called? Over to you, K2LAW.
That's the one that I believe they got the story of the radio on Apollo 10. And there's other series, you know, other, not series, other episodes of different things, but all dealing with NASA, all their flights. And it's called NASA's Unexplained Files, I believe is the name of it. And you can always Google that and see what that's about. But it's yeah, I guess on weekly on channel. Well, I get it on channel 170, which is what they call the science channel. It's not a science fiction channel. It's the regular science channel. They do have a lot of good shows on that particular channel. So very well worth watching. You know, watching a lot of their stuff all about wormholes, all kinds of things. Back to you,
Okay, we'll pick up the prison med at the John Gray, John.
KC2WTV. Paul, I was wondering, I think it was Saturday night, that exact show. You know, they have some good stuff on it. Did you see that one about the Mars orbiter that photographed the mummy? It found a mummy and also a large handgun on Mars. Did you see that one? Good stuff.
I missed it. I'll have to try to bring it up free on demand. You know, sometimes they have it sitting on the demand group. I gotta find that. Did they say which spacecraft took the pictures, John?
To my recollection, it was whatever is orbiting up there and taking the normal photographs. I guess somebody went through the photographs and so they showed you an image. Yeah, I don't know. This looked like a handgun to me, but they say, oh, definitely it's a large handgun.
Okay, it's probably Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, but with that, you could, if you had a coffee table sitting on Mars, you could take a picture of that. That's a good, high rise, that's the name of the camera / telescope that they have on board MRO to look down. The other ones were good too, but the MRO is the best. Yeah. Before that, they had Mars Odyssey. It's still working, still in orbit. Before that, they had Mars Global Surveyor, no longer operable. That was very good for many, many years. But actually, they need to replace MRO. There's plans on sending another one up there, bigger and better. Back to you, Dick. This WS-20.
Very fine. We had another person who wanted to make a comment. Who was that? Give us your call letters and name, sir. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. It's Glenn, KC2QIQ.
Never heard of you. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah. Funny, Paul, you mentioned that show. Before the show, there was about a week or so before that, NASA had made some kind of a release to the news media that about Apollo 11, that they were acknowledging that the astronauts heard music on the dark side of the spoon, dark side of the moon, during Apollo 11, and I think that was in reference to the reason why NASA released that as a yes, it happened, was because the there were a whole bunch of YouTube videos that had been showing up over about the last 2 months or so, where astronauts were being interviewed from Apollo 11 and basically describing the sounds that they heard. But what was interesting is no tape was ever released to the details or what the sound was that they were actually hearing. Back to you, the K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Paul, you made it sound like you actually heard that recording. Back to you, Paul.
Well, they played it on that show. And, you know, they had noise and, like, background music going at the same time. They really wanted to dampen out what you heard, I could tell. But if you listen real carefully, it was just it sounded like Intermod between two radios to me, a little on a higher frequency, but, you know, like a wishing sound. But I'm sure it was nothing about. Okay, so very good, Glenn. That means all the rumors and everything were out there, and NASA probably wanted to put an end to it. There's a lot of files and things that never were released that are loaded in probably countless tapes. There's some files that were lost, even on Apollo 11. Some of the communications that went to, I think, Ken Barra, actually was parked at the time. Some of the communications were deleted. It's not like today where they had tons of memory. Let's get rid of this and we'll just, you know, put this on in place. One of those deals. So a lot of lost stuff. But because it's lost doesn't mean, you know, there's some kind of conspiracy going on. Back to you, Dick.
Pink droids everywhere.
Just one more comment?
Go ahead, Glenn.
I think the only real reason why it became newsworthy was because of some of the comments that were being made in the EOs by the astronauts themselves. And they were saying was that the news we're hearing wasn't just on the dark side of the moon. It was all around the moon. But what would happen is when they would go outside of communication with Earth on the dark side, there was a period of time where they could shut down their equipment, record it, and then basically hold on to it, and then when they got back down to Earth, then they brought, because they told the astronauts, do not send that sound that you're hearing over live broadcast. And all the astronauts in those interviews, on those YouTube videos, all said exactly that. So now the question is, you can search YouTube anywhere you want. You can't find that recording.
Paul, you got a comment on that?
No, it's very interesting, but very good. No, I don't. The only thing I would like to say, well, first of all, it was Apollo 10, but that's irrelevant, as far as I'm concerned. Why was it only on Apollo 10? If you look at all the different radios and frequencies and the systems that they had between all these different radios that they had on board, Collins radio, and I'm surprised that any of it worked. Telemetry going back and forth. If it was a later flight, like Apollo 15 and 16, it would have been great because, you know, you would have heard, Dick would have heard the conversations. He was probably listening. Dick, did you ever make any recordings of the recordings that you did hear? That would be fun to have. You know, from the, I think it was the fifth, Apollo 15 and 16. Back there.
And what you're really asking is, did I dub those tapes? And those tapes are, by modern day standards, relatively low in quality. What we were doing, because we were limited in the amount of tape we had, this is a cassette tape recorder I was using, I would turn the tape recorder on whenever they talked and turn it back off when they stopped talking. So it's not very well documented as to what minute in mission elapsed time, so to speak, is this particular recording. And you could sometimes listen to the astronaut downlink channel for an hour at a time and hear nothing. And all of a sudden they feel like talking. And there's no warning as to when the next conversation is going to come. They click the mic and start talking. In fact, you never even heard the click of the mic. All of a sudden you just hear their voice. And some of it is kind of low in signal-to-noise ratio. Some of it's reasonably good. The good news is some of it's slightly candid. By that I mean, during the time they were not connected to the networks, they thought there's nothing between them and NASA. They didn't realize that I'm listening to this body line. Let me drop. So I would hear something about what's on their mind at the time. And one of the examples, for instance, was at the end of the day, as they were about to go to a sleep period, NASA would read up to them the current news. And you find out what's going on in Vietnam, and how the war is going, and what's going on in Europe, and so on. They made no comments. Pretty soon, the news got down to the sports reports. And when you heard the scores of the Houston Astros that particular day, they went into a cheer. That woke them up. But the Astros were doing was important. What was going on in the world, they had no comment on it. The stuff that was floating around in the cabin, they would make comments about that, particularly if it was chunks of food, and somebody would put his mouth around the chunk of food that was floating around. I'm trying to think of some of the other crazy things that I heard about them. I didn't hear it, but the guys in Europe that were using the dish at Bochum University, they were also listening to the astronaut downlink of Apollo 15 and 16. Let me drop them. And they heard comments about the astronauts complaining about the gas they were getting, the body gas they were getting from the Tang. They were blaming it on the Tang. The Tang was giving them gas. They were supposed to eat a certain amount of Tang, I think, in order to get their vitamin C or whatever. But as I said, I didn't hear that. But I think I told you guys the joke that the Apollo 16 astronauts did on NASA when they went behind the moon the very first time after the translunar injection burn, and they were about to do the to burn in the backside of the moon to go into lunar orbit. And they wanted to make sure that everything was lined up correctly. But theory, they alarmed NASA by saying, okay, we're going to make this burn at this number of minutes of mission elapsed time at the backside of the moon. And I think it was Mattingly who asked NASA, do I do that burn toward the moon or away from the moon? And he carefully timed that to be right at the instant where, as they're going behind the moon clockwise, top view, the moon casts a shadow on California, where the Goldstone dish was listening to them. But as they go behind the moon, that shadow sweeps across the Earth from west to east. And here I am on the East Coast, listening to the downlink. I heard the next 10 or 15 seconds of the astronauts laughing about, boy, did we pull a good joke on them. Let me drop them. So I heard things that Goldstone didn't hear on that particular portion of the mission. That was a fun thing. I also could hear the uplink. When NASA talked to them, or talked to the command module as it's going around the moon, most of the signal from Goldstone would miss the spacecraft, hit the moon, reflect off the moon, and come back down to me, because the uplink frequency and the downlink frequency were a couple of hundred megahertz apart. I could tune our receiver to the uplink and hear the moon bounce of the uplink, or tune it to the downlink signal and hear the astronauts. And I soon found out that there was a spurious signal in the downlink where I could hear the uplink by the spurious signal that was in their downlink. So we eventually were able to hear both sides of the conversation. I think I explained some of that before. Somebody did ask me once, let me drop it. Could I make a copy of those recordings? And they're kind of, by modern standards, they're not that great to listen to, other than the fact that we did it with homebrew equipment, that we should make a display for the Cradle of Aviation Museum. It would take a lot of work, and I'm not convinced that it would be that exciting, if you know what I mean. Over to you for any comments on this poll. WS2N, K2LIW.
No, except that it sounds like a lot of fun. I would have never gone back to work. That would have been it. I would have been glued to that antenna and receiver the whole time. So, I can see the problems with the recordings back then. Sounds like fun. If it was Apollo 11, you know, they would want to hang on every word. But the later ones, people started to lose interest. Well, not me, but the general public. While we're going to the moon again, you know. So, meanwhile, some of those were the more exciting missions. The television pictures got better. The riding around on the moon with the last three flights with the rovers, pulling up to these gigantic boulders and getting out and walking around. Very exciting pictures and move, you know, but, you know, the public lost interest. Back to you, Dick. No other comments. This is WS2N. RYY.
Great, Joe.
Question to you, Ari.
Joe was asking, was I hearing them in orbit around the Earth? And the answer is no. When they're in orbit around the Earth, they're at such a low altitude, and in those days, the tracking data relay satellites were not yet in full operation, so that if I could have listened to the downlink of the Tejas satellites, yes, I could have heard them in orbit. Once they're in space toward the moon, they're now high above the Earth, and I can see them as long as the Earth is in the right direction, if you know what I mean. But when they're in orbit around the Earth, no, I couldn't track them. One other thing I was going to mention to you, Paul, and that is that the actual computer on board has very little capability by modern-day standards. When it comes to all the so-called navigating, when you were doing a lunar landing, my impression is that all of those parameters as to how long to burn the rocket in what direction, that was all canned material that was put into the memory of their system. It wasn't really being calculated live because their computer on board didn't have the ability to do that. All that was being supplied from the Earth to them is my understanding. WS2N, K2RIW.
I get that. Something with the, completely different. We did talk about the computer net. It was some kind of a tube, I'm trying to think of the name of it, even before the cores came out. And there were cathode ray tubes. You know, I mean, this actually predated me. It was like the late 1940s. You can call them the Williams tubes. Two or three inch diameter things, and a whole bunch of them. You would have never been able to take them on a spacecraft, so they eventually developed the memory cores. Looks like a bunch of toroid coils. So that's what you were dealing with. I don't know if you ever saw these tubes. They call them Williams tubes, and then you had a pickup on the front of it. Check the capacitance. If it had a negative, it would be a zero, and then if it had a positive, it would be a one. You know. I don't know if you ever saw those things. That must have been a lot of power. You would have needed a lot bigger spacecraft than the Apollo to put these things on board. Back to you, Dave.
In order to be conservative on battery power, I think their actual displays, much of that was liquid crystal or the early equivalent of that. I don't think there was a cathode ray tube on board the spacecraft. Is that true, Paul?
No, but in the early late 1940s, they invented all these way to store RAM, and they used these tubes. Nothing but cathode ray tubes, and the phosphor would create a negative field on it, and then you would have a plate in front of it, and that would be, you know, that would pick it up, you know, like a capacitor. They would have like 70 of these things, you know, in rows and columns. You know. But I don't know if you copied me. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
I don't think you're talking about Nixie tube displays. You're talking about a kind of cathode ray tube storage system. I have used, for instance, a variable persistence cathode ray tube on some of the spectrum analyzers. I don't think that's what you're talking about. You're talking about a cathode ray tube used as a memory device called a Williams tube. Give me a couple of words on that, Paul. K2RIW.
I'm trying to remember the article I read. But, you know, it was talking about core memory with Apollo. And then they brought up this tubes that they had before core memory, and they were called Williams tubes. You know, there was another guy involved too. I think it began with a K, so Williams something or other. I'll have to look it up. But a Williams tube, and they were 3-inch diameter cathode ray tubes, and they would line them all up rows and columns. So if a cathode ray tube had a you know, if one of them would light up the phosphorus, the pickup in front of it, directly in front of it, metal plate, or, you know, that would be affected. That would be negative or positive. And that's how they had early RAM, random access memory. And in the real world, you couldn't see the tubes because all these, they were actually covered by these pickups. Sometimes they'd run another set of tubes in parallel just so that they could see the tubes and make sure everything was working okay. So some crazy setup like this in the late 1940s.